You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, turning my mind now to the Middle East, and I am very pleased, honoured in fact, to have a special guest who resides in Washington, D.C. His name is Benim Bentaleblou. He's the senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. And Benim's area of research or expertise is around Iranian security and political issues. So, Benim, welcome to the show.
Simon, it's a great pleasure to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, look, thank you first and foremost for being in New Zealand. I mean, this is the other side of the world, but we are watching with, well, actually a whole range of emotions around what's happening in the Middle East at the moment. And we know Iran is playing a critical role, but a very detrimental role in its operations, both inside its own country. I don't know if you followed here, Benim, there's been a lot of the stuff around the woman life freedom, but we're very conscious. Yeah, but very conscious at the moment, of course, the ongoing threats of Iran and its proxies towards Israel. And even as we speak, I think the Israeli Defense Forces have just launched I've been reading the news. They've launched preemptive strikes against one of Iran's proxies, Hezbollah. So if we could just take a step back, because I'm here to interview you, tell us what is Iran, if you will, and who are these proxies? Again, we hear about it a lot. But for a New Zealander who's not following Middle Eastern politics, can you just take us through a little bit of what is motivating this Islamic Republic and why is it so interested in developing these proxy relationships?
Sure. Well, this is a question of great importance, not just in Washington or in the transatlantic community, but really for all countries that's interested in stability and security in the Middle East. And in my view, that certainly does include New Zealand. The government of the Islamic Republic essentially cut their teeth on three ideological issues when they were in opposition before the toppling of the U.S. allied monarchy in Iran in 1979. And these guys cut their teeth on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. They cut their teeth on being anti-monarchy, meaning anti the Shah, and anti-U.S./anti-West. They have gutted one of these three institutions, meaning they've toppled the monarchy, they've taken over the state. They've ended all 2.5 millennia of the monarchic tradition in Iran, and they've replaced it with something that, even according to one of their own clerics, is neither Islamic nor Republic, but they call it the Islamic Republic of Iran. And this state is really more of a regime than a state. It's really, you could say, you mentioned the Women, Life, Freedom movement, you mentioned the vast protests, both inside that country as well as by the Iranian diaspora. This is a regime at war with its own people. In fact, the longest suffering victims of this revisionist ideology are the people inside of that country. Since 2009, you've heard these folks chanting, "Not Gaza, not Lebanon, my life only for Iran." So you have fundamentally an authoritarian and Islamist government that has an internationalist view of where it has to spread, or literally the parlance is export its revolution. And that's where the proxies come in, because the Islamic Republic, to overcompensate for both its conventional military deficiencies, which are changing, as well as its sense of ideational loneliness. You know, it's a Persian Shia state in a sea of Sunni Arabs, if you will. To be able to graft itself onto these issues, it's championed so many things like the Palestinian cause, not as a way to improve the life of Palestinians or Arabs, but really to be able to use that as a shiv of non-state-based violence against states that it harbors enmity with. So the Islamic Republic has preyed for 4+ decades on a whole host of downtrodden and dispossessed persons that over time it has either turned into terror groups that it created, or where there were already militia groups, it co-opted them. An example of the created is Hezbollah in Lebanon, or the Badr Corps in Iraq, or the Shia militias in Iraq. And an example of the co-opted is Hamas in Gaza or the Houthis in Yemen. Either way, they flow a very different kind of material support to these groups based on local or battlefield conditions. They can only really tap into these folks, again, where there are failed states, and again, where the population is downtrodden and dispossessed, and where they already harbor a grievance. And really, this is both economic war fighting, statecraft, and soulcraft all in one, because it's ideology and strategy for this terrorist regime. to be able to put guns in the people who are willing to shoot at the people that they want to shoot at. So in some ways, it's a long arm of state-based violence. It's also a way to turn the grassroots of many of these states against themselves, meaning against the capitals, which are often quite different or have to hedge. You know, countries like Iraq, for example, or use them as part of a war. You know, the Houthis were firing at the Saudis for quite a long period of time. And really, for the past decade and a half, the Islamic Republic has called this constellation of terror and proxy forces the axis of resistance. And they are working to overturn the regional balance of power and act on the other elements of what those, if you will, founding fathers of the Islamic Revolution have been saying, which is death to America and death to Israel. And just to put a nice bow on it, if you have to, you know, give it something strategic, you know, the first Secretary General of NATO, after his term was over, they asked him, you know, what's the point of NATO? Why was NATO created? And he said it was to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in. And then this Iran-backed axis of resistance is designed to keep the Americans out, the moderate Arab states down, and this constellation of Shia militias in, so that they can act on what they've said, which is this 45-year-plus crusade for death to America and death to Israel in the region.
Thank you very much for that, because I think actually it just situates Iran in a better position, I think, for listeners to understand, not just in itself, as you say, the overthrow of the Shah or the monarchy, but also its wider agendas and how it is using, or rather misusing, groups around the world. So, I mean, long and short, when they say death to Israel and death to America, the Islamic regime means it. This is not figurative, is it, or metaphorical?
Indeed, they mean it. And, you know, one need not only look at Iran. Sometimes this is much more about us in the West and who we are, and sometimes how we denude leaders and actors of agency. You know, we mistook, many in the West, unfortunately, mistook Putin when he was threatening to invade Ukraine, or the red lines that he drew there, and, you know, washed away his tough talk as domestic bluster or for domestic consumption. It would be a real shame to do that in the Middle Eastern context, especially because the Islamic Republic has married 4+ decades of rhetoric with actual policy, trying to effectuate some of the things that they've been saying. And perhaps just because it looks a little bit different than the way during the Cold War, the multiple iterations of Arab-Israeli wars, just because it looks a little bit different than that, doesn't mean it isn't any less dangerous. You know, one of the scarier things about the Islamic Republic is that it's able to bide its time. And I would say this larger ring of fire that over the past decade or two decades, they've arrayed around Israel through the different weapons they've given these different members of the Axis, is proof that they mean what they say.
Says me, one of the things I have noted with authoritarian, totalitarian, or theocracies in this case, is when they say something, they mean it. If I could phrase it in a slightly different way, Benham, I think sometimes in the democratic West, we think that there is bluster. But actually, as you mentioned earlier, when Putin and so forth say they're going to invade, they do. Here, we get concerned when the likes of Xi Jinping and China are saying, I'm going to take Taiwan. And as you say, Iran's been really explicit. They want to destroy Israel. And I suppose it's one of the questions I get asked here in New Zealand with my foreign affairs interests is, why is Iran so obsessed with Israel? Why is it that it needs to create this ring of fire? What's so existential about Israel that means Iran is going to put all its effort, it seems, and so much money into its weapons development and exporting? What is it about Israel that obsesses the Iranian regime?
You know, it's a great question. And this is really, again, it goes back to the heart of the ideology of those founding fathers of the Islamic Republic. They fused, again, their anti-monarchy, anti-Israel, and anti-American sentiment all into one. And this is not a contest or enmity between the Iranian nation and the Iranian people in Israel. This is the enmity of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has taken the public good and national interest of the Iranian state and sacrificed all of that on this ideational altar. You know, there is no border dispute. There is no population transfer dispute. In fact, compared to even some of the states that are normalizing relations with Israel now, there is no historical enmity In fact, the Persians and the Jews go back many thousands of millennia. You can even thousands of years to millennia. You can even go back to biblically to see the drastically different relationship, both biblically and empirically, between these two different groups. So this is a manufactured enmity that exists between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Israel. That is the sheer byproduct of the ideology of the men who have created and sustained this state. And much like they have held the Iranian nations hostage, they have held the Iranian state's foreign policy hostage to this anti-Western revisionist worldview, which means that they are working to undermine the regional balance that they believe is supported by the West. They're working to topple moderate and allied governments of the West. And again, they're looking to act on that old world anti-Semitism through the lens of this new world empowered, strong central state authoritarianism, which when you add all of this together is a very, very toxic brew.
Absolutely is. I've actually been struck, again, particularly around the woman life freedom protests we've had here, as across the world, but the number of Iranians or Persians who are saying that actually the regime doesn't represent them. In fact, it's not unusual to see at Israeli events or Persian events the flags of either country. There's actually a long-term relationship there which has been terribly disfigured and distorted by the current regime. But they're obsessed, Benham, obviously, with weaponry. Just to give people some idea, the likes of Hezbollah, based out of Lebanon, is it 100, 200,000 rocket ordnances, for example? They didn't make them these themselves, did they? Iran is supplying enormous amounts of weaponry to these proxies. Can you give us just some sort of sense of that scale?
Sure. And I mean, you know, back in Washington, where I live and work, by the way, you mentioned those protests. It was interesting to see, even at the limited pro-Israel rallies that existed there, the only other flags that you would see besides the American flag and the Israeli flag would in fact be the pre-1979 Iranian flag. And that's always something I mention when I travel, both to the Iranian hyphenated community in Europe and America, Australia, elsewhere, as well as to the Jewish American community, that again, this symbiosis exists despite the politics not existing. This cultural understanding and this cultural affinity exists. And without getting too crass, you can draw a sharp line between how the post-October 7 events in the Middle East were treated in Iran by the people versus from Morocco to Malaysia, despite some of those governments being much more, at least outwardly, pro-American or pro-Western. So one of the great contradictions of the world that we live in. But I digress. I don't think we have enough time to get into some of those social and historical drivers of that tension and of
another,
that friendship.
Another time, that would be fascinating
another,
in itself.
Yes, thank you. But to the arsenal, the Islamic Republic of Iran is the patron of this entire axis of resistance. And Tehran, for almost two decades now, according to U.S. national intelligence estimates, has been home to the largest ballistic missile arsenal in the Middle East. It used to procure select technologies from abroad. It would produce and then initially reverse engineer and then produce and then proliferate. So you could say the trend was PPP, procure, produce, proliferate. And proliferate to the hands of these non-state actors, as well as one state, the Assad regime, these destabilizing long-range weapons. And the old military balance in the Middle East used to be the good guys have jets, NATO, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and certainly Israel, and the bad guys have Scud missiles. You remember Gaddafi's Libya, Saddam Hussein's Iraq, Hafez al-Assad, Syria. The Islamic Republic is continuing in that tradition, both for cost and strategy and ideology, because it's a lot cheaper to fire one of these long-range strike weapons and requires less, ground support. And in fact, it requires a greater interceptor cost on the other side, something that the U.S. is facing in places like the Red Sea. But Hezbollah to the north of Israel in Lebanon has steadily scaled up its arsenal largely due to Iranian support, select Syrian support. They've gotten a few bibs and bobs of Russian military hardware through some indirect sources. And then they also have a domestic arms industry that the Islamic Republic has trying to stand up or has trying to bolster. But from 2006 to present, they've scaled up their arsenal of drones, rockets, mortars, and even some ballistic missiles to be up to 150,000 to 200,000 projectiles. They also have anti-tank weapons that are guided, and also select anti-ship weapons like anti-ship cruise missiles. Altogether, this is a very sharp knife against the neck of the Jewish state that Tehran has helped to sharpen over the past few decades. And first, it has proliferated this quantitatively robust arsenal, and over time tried to make it qualitatively robust, so more advanced, more precise. And with respect to some of the rockets and the missiles, what it's been providing Hezbollah with are these PGM kits, these precision guided munitions kits, designed to turn a rocket, which is an unguided projectile, into a ballistic missile, or a missile with a semi or quasi ballistic trajectory, which is a guided projectile. And, you know, if you nest these into larger salvos, the goal would be over time to overwhelm Israel's otherwise very capable multi-layered air and missile defenses. Thankfully, we haven't seen a lot of that yet, despite seeing a lot of violence coming out of Hezbollah since October 7. They were the first proxy of Iran to start firing on October 8th. But this is just one sample. But just to push away from the table and simplify, Hezbollah, as well as the Houthis who are in Yemen, these are non-state actors that, thanks to this Iranian support through proliferation and then the standing up of some domestic arms capabilities, they have more military capabilities today than some major European conventional armies. And that is precisely why we are seeing more violence in the Middle East. With the capability present, the intent to use them is seen as well.
So there must be an irony then, because as you talk about, obviously, Iran supplying effectively ever-increasing quantitative, so lots of, and better weaponry, there does seem to be, when I look, particularly, and not trying to blame the United States, but they seem to be holding back Israel at times. They are reducing arms sales or trying to reduce the flexibility of what something like Israel can do. I mean, that must have a destabilizing effect as well. One side's arming up and getting more vicious. The other side's trying to defend and yet being restricted. I mean, is that a fair reflection, or have I missed something?
No, I think you're partially right. You know, sometimes there's a tendency to focus on, these are three other P's for you. There's a tendency to focus on the politics that may push these sorts of policies. That's another P. But really, I think if you zoom out, this is the result of a philosophy, not politics or policy. And the philosophy is a philosophy of restraint by America, almost restraint at any cost. And because the adversary has sensed this, and, you know, talking about U.S. politics and policy, three very different American presidents, Obama, Trump, and Biden now, have talked about the Middle East as if it's a junk bond, a place to push away from. Yet they keep getting sucked back in despite their desire to pivot away. And that's because these global issues are actually much more integrated. Great power competition has a regional element to it. The new Cold War that many believe we're entering, if it's going to be like the past Cold War where it was cold in the US and the USSR, that means it's going to be hot everywhere else. That means everyone has a role to play. And we can't afford to disconnect the dots in this new era. And unfortunately, Washington's contradictory missions in the Middle East, at once de-escalation and at the other end deterrence, is undermining its bid to achieve both successfully. Because if you achieve, deterrence, or you're trying to bolster your deterrence, or, you know, update your deterrence, you would necessarily have to show that you have the capability and intent to escalate. And that undermines your de-escalation mission. And what the Islamic Republic has learned, and its proxy network has learned, that is, if you threaten a wider regional war, if you threaten to escalate early and often, it's more likely that Washington will enter, despite given its desire for restraint and deconfliction and de-escalation, and prioritize the de-escalation mission over the deterrence mission. And what that will mean, that 9 times out of 10 or 8 times out of 10, despite the otherwise very good track record of U.S.-Israel political ties, economic ties, and even tight military ties, that they would put the handcuffs on their ally rather than the handcuffs on their adversary.
And that's something observing down here. And as you say, if you've got a deterrent strategy and a de-escalation strategy, they're going to clash.
They're going to be in tension.
And we've seen, yeah. I mean, we've seen Iran, I used the term earlier, and I know you use it a lot, around proxy war or a shadow war. Iran, a good few weeks back, became quite explicit. For the first time, they launched over 300 drones and rockets towards Israel. That was quite, I mean, terrible, but remarkable in itself. I mean, is this showing a change of direction from Iran?
Certainly it is. And just because they haven't done it again, you know, there's been a great amount of talk about Tehran threatening the same kind of hard revenge. This is the kind of language they've been using for the first week after the killing of Ismail Haniyeh, Hamas's political chief in Tehran. You know, the word of the week across multiple hardline outlets, you know, first said by Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, and supreme leader in that country is a title meant to be taken rather literally. The word of the week was bloodlust. But ultimately, I would say the regime didn't back down, but benefited from this U.S. contradictory de-escalation deterrence mission. As you see recently, the attempts to kind of, through Egypt and Qatar, refoist the ceasefire onto the Israelis. Hamas just recently has rejected that attempt, so one wonders if that's going to be a driver for future Iranian escalation. But make no mistake, the risk tolerance of this regime is contrasted and contested by the risk aversion of the West. And I've been chronicling this for quite a period of time because I've studied the Iranian ballistic missile program. And this was a historic first direct overt attack from Iranian territory against Israeli territory. But they were training for these kinds of operations from Iranian territory for many years now. You know, during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, that's the conflict that got the regime interested in ballistic missiles, both for conventional and unconventional payloads, basically nuclear, chemical, as well as, you know, just regular high explosive military warheads. This arsenal grew, as we mentioned, over time to become the largest in the Middle East. And starting in 2017, the regime began to use these missiles overtly and directly from its own territory against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, against Kurdish positions, even against American bases, such that in 2024, the Islamic Republic of Iran in the first 4 months of 2024 directly and overtly attacked two nuclear-armed countries, despite not having a nuclear weapon of their own, Pakistan and Israel, and in some ways lived to tell the tale and is emboldened by that experience. And that's really the danger, is the more these weapons grow, the lower their threshold for the use of force will be, which will mean you can expect more, not less cycles of violence. And just because the regime has backed down and kind of swallowed, you could say, the bitter medicine of the killing of Ismail Haniyeh on its own territory, at least for now, it doesn't mean that these capabilities won't allow them to surge into the future and dangle their use as a sword of Damocles over Israel and the West at a time of their own choosing.
I'm pleased you share that because, again, I don't have your expertise, but after Iran fired that salvo into Israel, and there was a little bit of news, obviously, around them all being intercepted and how great it was, there still seemed, it didn't seem to send the deterrence, if you will, to Tehran. You get the feeling now that there's almost this, I don't know, is it the psychological warfare almost of Israel on a waiting game for when Iran will act again, which again shows that they don't feel chastised. They still feel that they're in control. They get to choose when to strike with the capabilities that they have.
There's a couple of things to unpack there. I agree with you because the Israelis responded to the April 13, April 14 barrage by Tehran on April 19, but they didn't publicly claim it. And certainly the Israelis performed and showed the world that they could do considerably more damage with considerably less weaponry. We believe it was an air-launched ballistic missile against a radar that was near a military site and near a nuclear site. So they were able to expose the soft underbelly of this regime. But because they couldn't claim it, it looked like the Islamic Republic won the optics war. And they drank their own Kool-Aid on that optics war, despite, again, realizing that they too have a soft underbelly. So on the one hand, the regime hit the gas, and on the other hand, the regime hit the brakes. And this cycle of violence and, you know, pauses in the war fighting in the region is quickly becoming the new normal. And one hopes that it doesn't become the new normal where the regime will forever threaten another direct attack against the Jewish state. But that is the trend line it's going in. And again, to talk about that role of American restraint, one reason we believe the Israelis didn't claim their April 19 military response was because Washington famously, in between April 13 and April 19, told them to take the win, is the quote that President Biden allegedly said. And I cautioned both Americans and Israelis then, but it's really a kind of a global caution of doing too much of a victory lap after April 13. The Israelis said that, you know, 99% of these projectiles were intercepted. There is reason to back away slightly from that figure. One, of course, is that why are Iranian drones successful in Ukraine when used by Putin, but not successful in the heartland of the Middle East? And that's simply because there are F-16s by America patrolling the skies of Iraq. There's the Americans and Jordanians over Jordan. And then there's the Israelis in Israel. So there's contested airspace, whereas in Ukraine, it's uncontested. The Russians have a largely freer hand there. So these cheaper, lower, slower flying weapons can have more military effect. But getting to the missiles, which are higher and faster flying, depending on the video that you look at, and depending on the source you take, 4 to 7 warheads landed inside Israel. And some of them actually did hit precisely a military base based on, again, public open source stuff. A C-130 plane was believed to be hit. Part of a runway was believed to be hit. Part of a base was believed to be hit. Just the outside wall. Thankfully, nothing, you know, catastrophic. But in this world, if you remember that this regime is also pursuing the ultimate weapon, which is a nuclear weapon, and it landed 4 to 7 hits inside Israeli territory. God forbid if only one of them was armed with an unconventional warhead, that would be a kind of game over or end of day situation. And given the fact that in 2002, you had then an allegedly moderate former president talk about Israel as a one bomb state, all of this adds more tension and more anxiety into the equation.
It's a great segue into probably one of my last questions, because conscious of your time, it is that nuclear side of things. Iran is still pursuing its nuclear agenda, and it does seem that the West's response to me, and I better turn to you as the expert, but to me, the West's response still seems muddled and uncertain. But is it fair to say that Iran is still aggressively seeking nuclear weapons capability?
Unfortunately, I would say yes. You know, this regime has mastered a new model, I would say, of proliferation, where it's still within the confines of the NPT, or it still has not chosen to leave the non-proliferation treaty, but politically is advancing a hedging strategy and technically is advancing a latency strategy that, when you put it together, is designed to give it the deterrent dividends of a nuclear weapon without having to pay the cost of getting caught with all the weaponization. And because weaponization is ultimately a political decision, but composed of many smaller technical processes, what you've seen, even just when you look at reports from this summer, that this regime is still interested in things with direct weapons applications, like computer modeling or metallurgy, they are trying to keep that knowledge fresh. And then you layer on some of the newer rhetoric we've seen from Iran over the past year, year and a half, where they talk about having all the capabilities to produce a weapon if they want to. They talk about it like a car where all they need to drop in is the engine. It's about all the disassembled parts, but they have to assemble it, that they could change their nuclear doctrine if the world changes their approach to Iran. So they are, again, weaponizing not just on the fissile material side. I mean, have not weaponizing past 90%. They've gone up to 84% purity in the past. They remain hovering around 60%, but enrichment of uranium is not linear. So 60% is not 60% of the way to a bomb. It is 99% of the way to a bomb. So it's logarithmic in terms of how fast you can scale up with enrichment rather than linear. But what it is weaponizing is really the fear of the West of an expanding atomic infrastructure. And really there are shortcomings, not just in American policy or European policy, but even together to marshal international pressure at places like the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Governors. If we are unable to really engage in even real meaningful diplomatic censure, it took 18 months for the current resolution of censure, which came out late this spring, early this summer, to be issued by the Board of Governors in Vienna, then what are we to do on the economic front or the military front or the intelligence front? And how much of a meaningful deterrent is that if Tehran is seeing diplomatic pressure take this time and be this watered down?
Yeah, from my observations down on this side of the world, Iran doesn't really seem to be too fussed, to put it rather simply, by what the West and excuse me, and others are doing. It does seem, and I'm not trying to wave a partisan flag here, but I think it was Trump, I might have that wrong, but went down more the unilateral sanctions rather than trying a multilateral approach. And that seemed to have an impact. I think it probably says me, and do correct me on this, one of the reasons Iran's been targeting him, I think, has even been suggestions of assassination attempts. Am I right in reading that somewhere?
You're right. You're right, not just on the politics side, but on the threats against his life, threats against his former cabinet and high-ranking national security officials that served in his government, and even on the election hacking side. And you don't have to take my word for it. Increasingly, you've had a steady stream of official Office of Director of National Intelligence commentary and Department of Justice commentary about Iran's nefarious role here. We should say the role of the Islamic Republic of Iran in this instance. And you mentioned a word that does get many folks on this side of the world, be it in New Zealand or in Australia, where I hop to hear from, and that's unilateral sanctions. I remember, and I was in Washington and party to many of these fights, and I still have the scars of the pre-deal, during deal, post-deal, and now allegedly back into whatever may come situation. And, you know, many doubted the capability of the Trump administration's unilateral sanctions. And understandably, you know, the threat of sanctions in the academic literature can overperform the actual use of these sanctions. Many, you know, multinational financial institutions and treasury departments around the world believe in multilateral rather than unilateral sanctions having a greater effect. But here, the macroeconomics tell a very different story. And about a year and a half to 2 years' time, the Trump administration was able to not only recreate, but exceed the macroeconomic pain caused by a decade plus of multilateral sanctions. And that's why they're after him, because of his success. And again, you don't have to take it from me. For some reason, these quotes have fallen short in Washington. But while Washington was doubting and continues to doubt, if you come back, and you are most welcome to, you know, you can engage with folks in D.C. and they'll say, oh, maximum pressure. And that was the name of this policy. They'll say it failed. But when you look at what the former Iranian president said, when he said that Trump's oil sanctions hurt the regime more than the 8-year Iran-Iraq war, and then you had three times in 2019 to 2020, the former oil minister say the oil sanctions now have done more damage than the 8-year Iran-Iraq war. That tells you all you need to know, that the West had managed to craft, or one element of the West, we should say, just Washington, had managed to craft a pressure policy that did not require firing a single bullet. And it had more than 8 years of a total war effect on the regime. And for some reason, Western politicians and policymakers were thumbing their nose at this policy just because the guy who issued it, they didn't like. That's an own goal, in my view.
Sums up a lot of democratic politics. I'm not referring to American Democrats, but yeah, we get similar dynamics down here. Benham, certainly when I was chairing foreign affairs, between the multilateral approach, which most New Zealanders seem to focus on, rather than sometimes the unilateral. But let's try to end on a positive, because obviously we've talked a lot around the major problems, and particularly coming out of the Islamic Republic. I mean, what can little countries like New Zealand do? How do we help contribute towards peace in the Middle East? I know that's a big question, but are there some thoughts or suggestions?
You're right. No, because there is a way actually for New Zealanders to marry their head and their heart on this issue. You know, even just kind of socially engaging with folks here, there's great interest in the ceasefire. There's great interest in making sure the peace and the prosperity that New Zealanders enjoy is something that the world can be able to enjoy. You know, we joked before that sometimes New Zealanders can feel as if they're on holiday from history. But the dividends of that holiday, New Zealanders genuinely want for the rest of the world as well. And the only area where I would say there's bad news in this is that, yes, you can achieve that, but there's no way out but through. And getting, you know, the folks at MFAT and then the full like foreign minister and then the prime minister and then having this be official policy of you know, standing with the Iranian people in practice and in principle. So step number one there is, you know, more Magnitsky designations. I think New Zealand, as well as Australia and the U.S., had their first ever trilateral historic Magnitsky human rights anti-corruption sanctions in December 2022, if I'm not mistaken, a mere months after the Women, Life, Freedom movement kicked off. That was historic and great to see, but it has to be continued. New Zealand has not to be, should not be afraid of naming and shaming the people who are engaging in systematic oppression of the Iranian youth and the brave women who are leading these protests. That's number one. Number two is that New Zealand is a member of this very important intelligence sharing alliance called the Five Eyes. And in my view, all the Five Eyes countries need to see 2020 on the Iran threat in this 2020s decade. So New Zealand should prescribe in its entirety the long arm of this Iran-backed terror, both for national security purposes as well as for domestic law enforcement purposes. And that's the prescription of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And then number three is, you know, when it does see these boom and bust cycles of violence in the Middle East, to connect the dots between patron and proxy, that the Islamic Republic is not the champion or the defender of Gaza. It's the force that's willing to fight to the last Gazan to achieve its cynical and ideational aims. And more calling out of them there can go a very long way in course correcting New Zealand's policy on Iran.
Well, that's why I'm really grateful that we've actually taken a lot more time than I thought, because this is fascinating and we could go on. But I think you're right. And one of the reasons to have had you on was to draw New Zealanders' attention to exactly what you just said around what's happening in the likes of Gaza. Iran is using that location, those people, for its own ends. And I'd also add, as a little bit of context for listeners, you know, the reach of the Iranian regime does get to here in New Zealand. We know of their interference through the IRGC. Is the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, which we still, by the way, Benjamin, in New Zealand, have not, repeat, not designated as a terror entity, which is a shocker. And I would add, too, because listeners know I'm a great proponent for Magnitsky legislation. I've worked with Bill Browder quite closely for many years, but unsuccessfully, I have to admit to you, to get Magnitsky legislation in play here in New Zealand. We touched very briefly earlier about multilateralism. That seems to be the New Zealand government's, or plural government's, approach over years, that the desire for Magnitsky is lacking, which is unfortunate because it would have such an impact, not only on despotic regimes like Iran, but so many others.
Concur. And, you know, that's why there's room for cautious optimism here, because you're hearing some of the right sounds, at least within society in this country. And, you know, there's, again, because of the real desire to have, you know, I'm borrowing a line here, but to have statecraft for New Zealanders also be soulcraft, you can do well by your head and do well by your heart. It may seem a bit unorthodox. It requires risk. It requires a bit of escalatory behavior. It requires a change in the otherwise somewhat more respectfully passive attitude of some folks here. But the willingness to call a spade, the willingness to stand for those values will go a long way in defending those first and foremost in this country, in New Zealand, where currently we're filming, and then moving forward. So there's ample opportunity. You say the right things, then you can eventually do the right things and then affect the right outcome. So, you know, calling those who engage in the systemic the corruption and rights abuses in Iran, calling them out, targeting their assets, and doing it in a multilateral fashion. The Europeans are doing it. The Australians are doing it. The Americans are doing it. The Canadians, after a rancorous 12-year debate in their country, have fully prescribed the IRGC in its entirety. I think it's time the rest of the Five Eyes partners do so as well.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. And look, Benham, I am so grateful that you have not only given us time, but so much time. And I'll take you up on an earlier offer too, that we'll have to have you back on, because this is obviously not only a contemporary issue, but a big one and a deep one. So look, thank you so much for your time and for joining us, and may the rest of your time in New Zealand go well.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
So listeners, that was Benham Ben Talablu. He's the senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies based in Washington, D.C., and an expert in Iranian security and political issues.
From caps to tees and bags to bumper stickers, we have you covered. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.